just a few weeks ago. Good song, and thanks for listening, but stay tuned because Language to Language is next with one of your hosts, Peter, so don't turn off the radio just yet. So here is Mormon Crosses.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
he was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective. News 101 is Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced student and community newscast, bringing you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective. Tune in Mondays and Fridays at 5 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Live streaming and podcasts are available online at citr.ca.
The April's issue of Discorder is headed your way. Be sure to pick up a copy of Vancouver's finest music and culture rag. The cover feature this month is cool.
I know it's cool, but who's on the cover?
Oh, it's cool.
Yeah, I know it's cool, but who's on the cover?
Well, Ryan, cool, the band. Plus articles on Teenager, Reef Shark, Zoo Age, and Fantasy Prom.
You have 9 saved messages.
Why do I ever answer your phone? Why you can't freaking pick up your phone? Talk to me. I thought you liked all your baby mama drama.
All the crazy things that I did. I'm sitting here.
All by myself.
Well, I'll be so frustrated, caught up in my own emotions, motionless through all this commotion. What the hell is going on? I used to be smooth like ocean, chasing the girls from ocean to ocean, and now my life is just a roller coaster. Enough to get you sick from the motion. What's my devotion? I'm devastated, trying to find peace with me, my baby mama. I seem to see someone never get caught up in all the drama. I'm like, oh shit, I must be karma for all the dirty little deeds that I did when I was away from my kid and my baby mama. I'm like, oh shit, I caused my own drama. I was waiting to deal with things, did my night. I was thinking about my own banana. When it should have been more like a traditional warrior man. Walking a wall fat, but I'm locked up in this white man's world. They won't let me out like I'm trapped. So I gotta stay strapped just to survive and stay alive.
My baby mama, my baby mama, my baby mama, my baby mama drama. Can't live without my baby mama drama. Go crazy for my baby mama drama. Can't live without my baby mama drama. Go crazy for my baby mama drama. My baby mama,
uh-huh.
My baby mama,
uh-huh.
Baby mama drama.
Come on, baby, love me one more time. I promise, honey, I won't mess it up this time. I'm the man that you want me to be. And I'll stray away from the crazy creed that you don't want me to be. See, I love you because you're across the sea from me. All the way from Canada to Spain to come and see me. I'm so sorry for being a G, and I know I don't deserve you still. You're loving me, you're confusing me, because you're forgiving me so easily. And I know that recently I haven't been treating you like the queen that you deserve to be. I haven't lost my own integrity, but selfishly, savagely, chasing the booty like a kid's fiend for candy, trying to gratify, satisfy, justify my need for speed. Living a fast life, in my past life I must have been a hash pipe, cause I'm always smoking weed, trying to succeed. And now I'm lost in my own pain and sorrow, always wondering what's gonna happen tomorrow. Baby, didn't mean to be so misogynistic with your heart when I tore it out, stepped on it and twisted it. I tried my best to be optimistic, extra charismatic. I have been sexy crazy like a sugar high fanatic. Nowadays, with you, baby, all I'm ever feeling is some crazy ecstatic. What, my baby mama,
my baby mama, my baby mama, my baby mama drama. Can't live without my baby mama drama. Go crazy for my baby mama drama. Can't live without my baby mama drama. Go crazy for my baby mama drama. My baby mama,
uh-huh.
My baby mama,
uh-huh.
Baby mama drama. My baby mama, my baby mama, my baby mama, my baby mama drama. Can't live without my baby mama drama. Go crazy for my baby mama drama. Can't live without my baby mama drama. Go crazy for my baby mama drama. My baby mama,
uh-huh.
My baby mama,
uh-huh.
Baby mama drama.
End of message.
Welcome back to CITR. And today we got a full house with me, Gennardio Sullivan, and Woody Morrison is back co-hosting with myself and Peter Rodriguez, who will translate what happens here on the show in Spanish. And then we have a special guest who I'll let Woody Morrison introduce.
Okay, well, counting a hinudikya ang. Atlantis hat iode aging. Got akas deo qualakin. In Haida, I'm called Kaunsanga. I'm of the two-headed eagle clan of the Haida Nation, and I'm from the eagle moiety. I guess that's the word moiety, but in Haida we call it kuala. So anyway, I've had the opportunity to visit with Bruce a few times in a coffee shop. I was listening to him talking about some a book he'd authored on evidence in a criminal trial or something like that. Oral history. Oral history.
Just wait. So we're going to let Peter translate for you.
Well,
and as we set up the show, and then we'll introduce. Yeah.
Okay. Hello, everyone. This is Peter Rodriguez, and y yo voy a traducir esta tarde la conversación que vamos a tener con nuestros invitados. Bienvenidos a Language to Language.
How are we going to do this?
Okay, so...
Can we reach Mike?
He's translating for you, Woody, so let's just...
Okay, so anyway, I'll introduce Bruce Miller. He's a professor out here at UBC in anthropology, but I heard him one day, he was talking to someone there in the coffee shop about oral history as evidence in a court trials, and also one day he mentioned that he was... contracted to do a report on, I guess, something like systemic violence in the Vancouver Police Department, and was to provide it to the Commission on Murdered and Missing Women, but something went awry and it wasn't done. So I'm hoping we can talk about that first, about that report.
Okay, so can you translate?
Yeah, basically, prácticamente vamos a hablar el día de hoy con Bruce Miller, quien es un profesor de antropología de acá de la Universidad de UBC, y nos va a estar contando sobre un reporte de criminología contra la mujer que ha escrito y ha preparado.
Woody overheard me talking about a book I wrote called Oral History on Trial, which was the culmination of a number of years' work that I did on oral history evidence in Canadian courts. And following the Dalgamuk decision in 1997, the Supreme Court had ruled that oral history evidence would have the same footing as written evidence. And subsequently, the Crown, the Department of Justice, hired someone who ended up creating a theoretical model and knocking oral history evidence out all across the country in more than 15 cases.
Básicamente, el libro habla de los reportes que se hicieron en la corte basados en los reportes que se han hecho sobre 50 casos particularmente.
So I got brought into three trials on this and eventually examined the footnotes of the Crown expert and found that he had misrepresented the literature on this and wrote that book to try to give the legal system a better idea of who oral historians are and how they ought to understand that kind of evidence and to take on the Crown's counterarguments against all that. So that was something that Woody and I talked about a few years ago.
And Woody, what were your thoughts on the idea of being able to give oral history in a court case?
Well, I was surprised at what he was saying because I was trained as an oral historian, and the training started when I was 3 years old. And it isn't simply just sitting around a campfire listening to stories. It's a very rigorous system. When I would sit down with this old man, they'd always start with the same thing when I would walk in. What did you see and what did you learn? So I had to learn to become observant, to see not only what's supposed to be there, but what's not supposed to be there. Then the old man would say, "Outla guna, sit down, dear boy. Aji dan kendang song. I'm going to show you something. So don't eat, prepare yourself." So there was a way in which I would sit, relax, close my eyes, and clean my mind. So it was almost like a hypnosis session, and then they would start talking.
Todos los reportes revisados terminaron en un libro que en la actualidad lo que hacen es reproducir la tradición oral que tienen los aborígenes respecto a su cultura. La intención es incluir el tema de tradición oral justamente en la parte legal para ver cómo se puede introducir en los procesos legales.
And while I have you here, Peter, is there anything similar in your culture that speaks to oral history?
In Ecuador. We have a lot of oral history, for uh-huh. sure, but not in the way that we are talking today, you know, like use that for a legal process or things uh-huh. like that, you know.
But in the past, was your oral history, like, used in the governmental system?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Governing system. Yeah, okay, yeah. Cool. All right, would you like to add anything else, Will?
Well, just to say that the Crown came up with a lot of arguments as to why people like Woody ought not to be given standing in the court. And just to tell you, one of them was the concept of contamination. And so they had it that if people like Woody read the books, the anthropology and history of his community, he couldn't give testimony because it would be contaminated. It wouldn't be from a unitary, a single source. And so in that book, I try to argue against those kind of crazy viewpoints.
Principalmente lo que se encontró fue, por ejemplo, una historia sobre la contaminación de las aguas. Entonces, se está tratando de ver la forma en que esta tradición oral ya viene hablando de ese tema desde hace mucho tiempo.
Well, how do you think presenting evidence with oral history would have aided in, like, the Missing and Murdered Women's Inquiry or the Frank Paul Inquiry, for instance?
Well, I think the families of the missing should have been given more time to present what they were concerned about. In that inquiry, most of the time was given to the police, and they were advantaged in all that. By the way, I think the big turn in that commission was that instead of being a study commission, it was one in which adversarial cross-examination could be used.
Yeah, one of the things that was sort of failed at the beginning of the inquiry was the fact that the families were not engaged in setting the terms of reference. And then once the terms of reference were set, it kind of changed the course of the inquiry, didn't it?
That's right. And it was not a satisfactory inquiry for those families, that's for sure.
And it started with the terms of reference
yes.
and the fact that Wally Opal was now the commissioner who had previously been the attorney general who had denied an investigation 20 years previous, so then it also made it like a conflict of interest in the eyes of the family and our community of people.
Lo que se está tratando también de hacer es usar la información que existe para relacionarla con los temas de las familias, cómo han sido afectadas las familias y cómo justamente esta tradición oral se puede utilizar para resolver estos casos.
Yeah, so originally when I was contracted to come into this, I think there was a split in the professional staff because I was asked initially that I read 1,000 pages of internal documents that mm-hmm. had been brought into this, and I was going to give a PowerPoint and talk about the issues of systemic racism, how it works, common sense racism, institutional and systemic racism. And that's how it was going to go. And then somewhere in between all that, it became flipped. And now it's going to be this adverse cross-examination. And then they made it very clear to me, the senior staff, that they had no interest in it. So at that point, I realized there was that this wasn't a process I wanted to participate in.
Am I allowed to ask you whether, like, Lori Schreiner was involved in your report? Like, did she have, like, I mean, she suffered from systemic racism. She wasn't listened to because she was a female officer, and she was ignored for the good part of, you know, during the time that the people were calling for an investigation, she was one of those who was calling for it and was completely ignored. So was she a part of your report?
Well, I signed a confidentiality agreement,
Uh-oh. So
I can't say too much. But let me say that there were some good people involved in that down there.
Mm-hmm.
But that the group they put together was I would say, the worst group of racists you could gather together.
Yeah.
And that's who their special team was.
And that continued to plague the downtown east side to this day. There is a lady who just went to court yesterday to Hornby, 800 Hornby Street. Her name is Bobby O'Shea. She is suing the VPD for police brutality. 2 years ago or so, she was picked up for being inebriated in the downtown east side. Well, 20 years previous to that, we've been losing our women left, right, and center who have been murdered and have gone missing. And the police, the VPD, failed the women in the community by not investigating. Meanwhile, they can pick up this lady on a dime for being inebriated, throw her in jail, hobble tie her. And so now she's suing the VPD. I'll just let him catch up to us. Peter.
Yeah, it's too much information, but anyway, I will try.
Yes, thank you.
Es mucha información realmente, pero todos los estudios que se han realizado están bajo un manto de confidencialidad, así que no se puede revelar quiénes son las personas involucradas, pero básicamente lo que se está tratando de hacer es analizar muchos casos como el de esta señora que fue arrestada, estuvo ayer en corte, promoviendo justamente el tema para ver si pueden tener un caso con los temas de violencia policial.
Okay, all right. So we're speaking with Bill. Bill is Bill?
No.
Oh, Blake.
You made me forget your name.
Bruce.
Well,
I'm me bad.
You know, we can talk about all these horror stories, and we know they go on, and they don't stop. They just keep going. Because it's, well, like you said, systemic. It's so deeply rooted in the system. So the question becomes, where do we go from here? And so I keep asking these young people who are doing protests, what is your end game? Where do you want to go with this? I listen to the students out here at UBC talking about their research and their doctoral dissertations, and the word decolonization keeps coming up. And so I asked him, well, what do you mean by that? If I was to snap my fingers right this moment and you say you're decolonized, what would we look like? How would we behave? What would our value system be then? How would our family, what would our family structures look like? And they don't know. I haven't gotten any that even hazard a guess as how to answer that. And so I'm working with the Vancouver Aboriginal Child and Family Services Society, and when they talk about the extended family and the best interests of the child, they don't understand what an extended family truly is. And so this is what I'm trying to do, is to be able to put down in writing what that family is. And also, you have ceremonies, like, for example, a court order to take a child away from a family. But you don't have any other ceremony to prepare the people for being separated. And so now your social worker has somewhat become like the priest or whoever it was in the residential school system. So now I want a ceremony that makes sure the disconnect doesn't occur between the child and the family. So that's one of the things I'm really concerned about. And I ask anthropology students if they get much information about kinship systems, and they do in a theoretical sense. So I don't know if that's what you teach.
Well, I do teach that, and I teach it in a practical sense, and I show the practical applications of... I work with the Coast Salish community over the last 38 years. And so we talk a lot about how family groups operate in a very practical sense around care for children, care for elders, all of the issues. And in the end, it comes to those details. So I think you're quite right. But I want to, can I add this about decolonization? So I've got two thoughts. One is indigenizing institutions that exist in mainstream society. Mm-hmm. That's one. And the other is creating freestanding institutions in Aboriginal communities. And so I've worked with tribal courts down in Puget Sound, for example, and Coast Salish people down there. And so I've advocated for the creation of similar institutions here. That's one approach. And the other is, what ways can we find indigenous principles and practices incorporated into our mainstream And, for example, here at UBC, we've done a little bit of that. Link Kessler is the director of working on those kind of projects. And I'm back to the police thing for a minute about the VPD, if I could. There is systemic racism in our society, and so the question is always, what do you do about it? Mm-hmm. And I just want to mention that the VPD produced a 300-page report about the problem of the missing women, in which they dismissed this issue in a couple of paragraphs. And so the effort that they've done reduces it to a technical expert exercise. And so technical people look in terms of narrow frames of reference, and the larger frame of reference is left out, and that's the one that concerned me.
Okay, so we're going to take a musical break, and then we'll come back and find the paragraph where they dismissed some of these ideas that we just talked about. Are you ready for that?
Well, it's okay. In the Lepard report. Have we got it?
I hope so.
She thought she knew it all, been through it all. Nothing new at all when she blew it all. Nothing cool at all, lost in the streets. Not a thought, the street, believing all the scene. People she will meet, trust her way too quick. Take a motor thick, hits up the brick. Sadness got her sick, drugs got her hooked. Eyes are always cooked, hopefuls got her booked.
Friday's job.
They let you all alone.
Friday's job.
Now you won't go back home.
Friday's job.
They let you all alone. And now
overlooked, sexual abuse seems to ever use to set a loop. Same as a noose, slowly killing her. Angry and confused, feelings filling her. Ice chilling her, makes her forget. Pain deep beset, broken trust she let. More than regret, self-hate and lust. Not enough rain to wash off disgust.
Friday's job.
They let you all alone.
Friday's job.
Now you won't go back home.
Friday's job.
They let you all alone. And now
wandering the streets, eyes open blind, pondering the sweets and evil she can find. Feels left behind and really all alone. No trust of men, not even on the phone. Out on her own, cold out the dark, chilled to the bone. A more sober heart, so good at art. Now she write her name on the wall for fame and custody to attain.
They left you all alone. They left you all alone.
Emotionally drained, physically ill, spiritually chained, sexually killed. Lashes deep distilled, make her flinch or cringe. Memories so drilled, shot the word syringe. Way off the hinge, caught in the trance. No leads off the bench, not a lot of chance. Her spots to advance, swimming up the stream. Drowning mumbles scream, wish it was just a dream.
Friday's job.
They left you all alone.
Friday's job.
Now you won't go back home.
Friday's job.
They left you all alone. And now they left you all alone. Now you won't go back home. They left you all alone. And now the spirits want you back at home.
Hola. Bueno, estamos en Language to Language y queremos solo mencionar o hacer una síntesis de lo que se ha conversado hasta ahora, pero me toca en español. Como decíamos, tenemos a nuestro invitado Bruce Miller, quien estaba conversando sobre el reporte que escribió y se terminó transformando en un libro sobre la influencia de la tradición oral en las comunidades nativas y cómo la pueden usar para temas legales, cómo defenderse en corte si apelan diciendo que es parte de su tradición oral, número uno. Y número dos, luego hay otro reporte en el que se enumeran ciertos abusos de tema policial y bueno, también sobre eso vamos a seguir hablando en este momento. We're ready, Gunnarji.
Oh, are we ever? This is CITR 101.9 FM, and we've been speaking to Bruce Miller, and we've been talking about the Missing and Women's Inquiry and some of the incomes and outcomes of the whole, a whole ball of wax. Mm-hmm. And now I'm going to share with you the VPD release's final report into the Picton investigation, and we'll compare it with Bruce's notes on the investigation. So Vancouver News 1130 puts this out. Vancouver police have released their lengthy report into the city's missing women and why serial killer Robert Picton wasn't stopped earlier. The massive report was supposed to come out on September 9th, but damning details have already filtered out through the Victoria Times, Colonists, and other papers. The police had compelling evidence pointing to Robert Picton as the murderer of the missing of the downtown east side for over 2 years before his arrest in 2012. However, the 450-page review says bad management, jurisdictional squabbling, and shoddy investigation work caused police to essentially ignore the pig farmer as he took the vulnerable women to Port Coquitlam farm and murdered them. Lepard says his report makes a series of recommendations, including improving information shared between the RCMP and the VPD, and he says those recommendations have already been implemented. Lepard says the August 1999, 13 more sex trade workers went missing, and evidence connects 11 to the Picton farm. And he blasts his own department for not recognizing sooner a serial killer was at work, but says much blame on the RCMP, which took the lead since Picton lived in their jurisdiction. So the RCMP had to respond, but has not said much about the Vancouver Police Department's internal review of the missing and murdered case in the downtown east side. Superintendent Janice Armstrong with the RCMP read a statement on behalf of the Deputy Commissioner Gary Bass, who is out of the province at the moment. And in the release, he says he received the 450-page report from Deputy Chief Doug Lepard on August 7th. And in fact, there was a team reviewing it for the purposes of providing a comment. He was hoping that it would not be released until September, but once it has been leaked out, what can you do? That happened during the Missing and Murdered Women's Inquiry, or shortly thereafter. The date of this report was August 20th, 2010. I just read it because, you know, you had talked about your report, and I was wondering if this reflected anything in your own report, Bruce?
Well, no. I think that's a sleight of hand game there, and that's what I was trying to say. Those are technical policing issues that got addressed there, and that's fine. But
can you repeat what you just said? I didn't have your mic on. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I think that the problem for that report is that it reflects technical policing issues. It doesn't get to the underlying heart of the matter, which is the question of systemic racism in the police force.
What is systemic racism in the police force from your point of view?
Well, it's underlying sets of perceptions about particular groups of people, and the perceptions become solidified in a schema, and they become ways you observe and understand people, and they're tied and connected to particular behaviors in relation to those, and so they end up forming discrimination against categories of people, and we've seen that in the city previously in other cases and so forth.
We see that within child apprehension cases as well.
Yeah,
too.
That's right. And so what I'm trying to say is that's there as a background variable. So the point is, what do you do about it? And this report didn't wish to do anything about it, nor did the commission
itself. You mean
itself.
The Vancouver, the police report?
The Lepard report that the VPD put out. They're looking at technical policing issues as opposed to the underlying social system that causes difficulty for people in the field. And when you assemble a group of people as bad as the group they assembled to be the specified investigation team,
so even if those things aren't stated in policy, it's how policy gets interpreted by the people who are enforcing it. And so the police can say, well, we have these regulations, but then there's some wiggle room in there as to how you're going to do it. And so once it becomes systemic, it means it's throughout the whole system. Mm-hmm. The system is governed by it, okay, rather than the system controlling it.
De lo que estamos hablando en esta parte es justamente de la discriminación racial por parte de la policía, del departamento de policía. Y Gunarji estuvo leyendo un artículo del diario sobre justamente el asesinato de una mujer que fue hace 2 años y sobre el cual se sospecha que existió racismo de parte de la policía para la investigación. Este es un comportamiento que se del cual se acusa a la policía. Entonces ese es el tema del que estamos hablando.
And I want to add that it becomes naturalized, so it's systemic, but it's also what's called common sense racism. People don't notice it because it seems to be to someone to be the way things are. It's natural. It's the state of affairs. And so discriminatory practices aren't even observable. I've found in doing this, in this case, looking at the documents here and some other work I've done previously, that those people can't, they can't even edit it out of their own written documents because they aren't able to theorize it, and so they can't edit it out. And it shows up in the way the kind of language they use about survival sex trade workers, about Aboriginal people and other categories of people. They don't edit it out, and it reflects their thinking. They don't understand it, but that's where a good institution does something about it.
Well, early in the case, I remember people asking the families, and it kind of gets back to Woody's idea of decolonization and rebuilding the family structure. The families were actually asked, where were you when this was happening? And it kind of reflected on us and our inability to care for each other. Woody, does that make any sense to you?
Well, yeah. Well, residential school destroyed that whole fabric. So I don't trust my sisters, I don't trust my brothers, I don't trust anybody. And I'm not about to help anybody unless I get paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so why should I be looking out for somebody? I've been taught to look out for number one.
Especially at a street level.
Yeah.
Lifestyle. And then Elizabeth Hunt took over for Robin Gervais. You talked about Robin Gervais being one of the lawyers that actually left because of the systemic racism, right? Can you continue on with that?
Well, yeah, I can't speak for Robin Gervais, but it seems to me she left in part because of the treatment she received at the hands of the senior counsel in this whole affair. And my guess is she perceived...
Good choice of words.
yeah. Yes. My guess is that she perceived nothing of merit was going to come out of this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I finished my report, but I withdrew it because I realized the senior counsel that nothing was going to come of this. They were not going to address the topic of systemic racism, although they were perfectly willing to go out on the sidewalk after the report and suggest their concern about that and their empathy for the families who, in fact, were given almost no time to talk about their affairs. And despite the problems of families, you know, some of those families did care about those women,
mm-hmm,
and did make long-term efforts and went to senior leadership Aboriginal organizations. And, you know, by the way, I knew about what Picton was doing several years before this was going on.
Well, even the tribal police knew, but they did not have the authority to begin an investigation.
Básicamente, de lo que se acusa o lo que se está identificando es como un racismo sistemático, es el término que se está usando ante la actuación de autoridades y policía principalmente. Todos deberíamos recibir el mismo trato, por lo tanto, no debería hacerse el mismo tipo de investigación para cualquier caso criminal que existe y no que se evidencien estos aspectos de racismo sistemático.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to add that it's more than about Picton. I mean, that's just one guy involved in this big,
yeah,
larger thing. And things are still happening in the downtown east side and elsewhere.
Yes,
up on
across
the
country.
Across the country and on our highways and so,
mm-hmm,
forth.
Truth.
And it's that larger issue. Although I got to say, my own experience with commissions, some commissions I think are good. This one I don't think was.
Oops.
And the idea of a national commission gives me a little bit of trepidation because of the big failure we had here. If it's not going to be it's going to be set up an adversarial cross-examination. You know, I like to say this, the families that did get to go in there, I applaud their sheer courage to show up in that place in front of all those lawyers. You know, they allowed a great many lawyers to be hired for the police and almost
none
for the families.
It was like a nightmare, I swear to God. There was a sea of lawyers backing up the VPD, which is the Vancouver Police Department, and a sea of lawyers backing up the RCMP, and then a sea of lawyers backing up the commissioner, and two lawyers there to represent the marginalized woman, that was Elizabeth Hunt, and then there was Cameron Ward, who represented 26 families of the missing and murdered.
Este es un se está conversando el caso puntual de una un caso que hubo en corte donde estuvo un representante de las 26 familias involucradas y estuvo a la policía de Vancouver y también tuvo el RCMP en este caso.
Yeah. And so the families were right. They were so courageous, and they went there for the full 8 months, sitting there, listening to the injustice and seeing the inequality in this within this process. And at the same time, though, when Elizabeth Hunt came along to represent the marginalized women, she talked a great deal about the displacement, beginning with the residential schools, and how that affected these women's and their lives to the point where they actually went missing and became murdered because they had no support. They did not have the family support because of the displacement issues that we have lived with for generations and generations. And therefore, where did we have to turn when we're going missing or when we're at risk of being murdered? Woody?
Yeah, see, that's part of the problem is that a lot of times the families didn't come to offer support until they found out something was really wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so had there been the traditional family structures, you would always know when something's wrong. I listened to a woman from Africa was talking about growing up in a village where she said the moment you walk out of your house, everybody knows what you're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
They know what you're feeling just from your body language.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are no secrets. But here, they've beat it into us that you got to keep secrets, you got to keep your mouth shut, you don't ever tell, you keep it inside even though it's eating you alive.
Yeah.
And so when you have that sort of a situation, it's easy for people like Picton to go in and pick off the wounded birds.
Just prey on the women.
Yeah, just to prey on them. So that's why I'm trying to do what I can to raise this whole issue of starting to find out who our family, what our family kinships are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, when I was growing up, I had 12 mothers. You know, they're all the same crest as my mother, the same generation, so I called all of them mother, the O. And the children were my brothers and sisters, but that was frowned upon. We weren't supposed to do that. Unfortunately for me, I was being trained by the old people. And so I was doing these things and the others weren't.
And that system was replaced by the foster care system after the residential school. So some of us did have 13 or 14 mothers, but it had nothing to do with our culture, you know. So it really messed with our heads and our sense of belonging.
Bueno, como hemos estado escuchando, básicamente es también cómo se involucra a los temas de la familia, de todos estos niños que crecen en estas escuelas en las que son separados de sus familias y finalmente pues llegan a tener 12 o 13 madres, pero que no pertenecen realmente a su cultura. Es un tema muy profundo y muy serio que estamos tratando el día de hoy. Estoy tratando, estoy haciendo mi mejor esfuerzo para traducir también. I'm trying to do my best effort to translate everything.
Yeah. So we were talking to Bruce Miller about a report that he wrote but never actually submitted.
No, I submitted it.
Oh, you submitted it.
It was a complete report because there was a pretense later on their part that I hadn't submitted it.
Oh, okay.
And that was very interesting because it had been received. I was down there at their palatial quarters up high up above the city in the downtown, looking out to the over the city. And no, it was complete and done. And then I wouldn't allow them to release it. And then later, when they're getting beaten up by the media, they sent me an email saying, could they now release it? And I wouldn't let them. And then when the national media got on this issue after Robin Gervais resigned,
mm-hmm.
they had tempted to pretend I hadn't done it. Yeah, oh no, I'd done it. Uh-huh. And they didn't want it at all and told me so and said they would go after me. I'd be on the cross-examination for weeks, which is completely nonsense because they wanted the police uh-huh. on the stand giving their story.
And they were. Continually. They took up a lot of time.
Yeah.
A lot of time. And then we have this Forsaken report, and in the report there are something like 60 recommendations, and so far only a couple of them have been applied. What did you think of the Forsaken report and some of the recommendations?
Well, I want to back up a minute,
okay.
if I could. I just want to say that there was a split, I think, in the professional staff. And some members of the professional staff wanted this report. They're the ones who asked me to write it. They're the ones who provided me the documents, the internal documents. And so we got some inkling of what was going on there when some charges of sexual harassment were linked to the media. And that is just an indication of the, I think, some of the turmoil going on inside the commission. There was a split on all this kind of topic. So anyhow, my larger thinking is that, to me, despite these technical recommendations that have been made, I still think the key issue's got to be addressed.
Bueno, el tema es que el segundo reporte que hizo Bruce Miller justamente terminó publicado y terminó con 60 recomendaciones. Muchas de esas recomendaciones son las que está comentando en este momento cómo serían aplicadas.
And so one of these things has been to suggest to give police more investigatory powers regarding people they regard as somehow missing. And to be perfectly honest about it, I'm always concerned when police are given additional investigatory powers.
They never give them up.
That doesn't seem like relevant. You know, to back up even further, one of the problems was that the police claimed that the women weren't missing. They were gone. You know, they were on holiday or they'd gone off to visit somebody.
Yeah, they're off to Paris.
Yeah, which just completely ignores the lived reality of those people. Mm-hmm. You know, the economic status of those people, the psychological status of those people, the way they're connected to that region. And it was just absurd. I do have to say that there were some people who were who understood this down there, but they weren't listened to.
Yeah, that's right. I remember a fellow by the name of Dixon.
Yep, that's who I'm thinking
of. Who worked for the tribal police.
Yep.
You know, he fought furiously for an investigation and was ignored for something like 10 years. And then when they finally were starting to listen to him, they actually shut down the tribal police sector. I don't know if that's the right terminology for it, but
yeah, he
Alvin knew, Dixon.
No, that wasn't his first name, but he knew what was going on.
Oh yeah,
and made it clear. And mm-hmm. the people who work downtown Eastside in the healthcare sector,
like the
and
nurse.
So forth.
Remember the nurse that had worked there for so many years, who just died this last year.
Yeah.
What was?
Oh
her
yeah,
name?
Yeah.
What a beautiful lady that was.
Well, I've got to say that I gave the commission the recommendation that they talk to street nurses in the downtown east side.
Yeah.
Because those people know what's going on downtown. Those many of the missing women are their clients
mm-hmm.
or were their clients, and they were aware of what was happening. And one thing, one of the nurses who ended up testifying ended up getting scrutinized, and people were asking her questions about how much her house was worth, and,
mm-hmm.
and she was demeaned and demoralized
yeah.
on the stand
mm-hmm.
there, and her testimony was neglected, and the experience was horrible.
Yeah, that was sad. The whole process was very sad and disheartening, and then in the end to get 60 recommendations that really don't reflect the needs of the families and those who have gone missing. Although the women and some of the families have been compensated $50,000.
Hush money.
Hush money.
Básicamente, lo que se está explicando ahora es cómo esta discriminación en las investigaciones se ven reflejadas, pues, ¿no? Debido a que se trata de evadir ciertas realidades, y simplemente si se reporta, por ejemplo, una mujer que está perdida, se dice que está de vacaciones o se fue de viaje o algo así, cuando eso, por el estatus de estas personas que no tienen dinero, no es tan real. Entonces es muy fácil decir que se fueron de viaje y que no están desaparecidas. Y luego toman 2 o 10 años investigar, si es que se llega a investigar. Entonces esa es la discriminación de la que se está hablando.
You know, but another way of looking at it, it might be hush money, but some of these processes help people get their voice and learn how to stand up and how to speak and how to proceed and all this. And an example of that was Gladys Radek. Can we go back to that?
Sure.
Gladys Radek was a woman living in native housing downtown, right across from the Tinseltown Mall. She was watching Aboriginal people there get abused for a long time. And she eventually got shoved around, tried to take it to the police. They ignored her. And so she had ended up with a Human Rights Tribunal hearing, and I was the expert on that and looked at all the documents related to that. And it was horrible what was going on down there. Some Native people were forced to walk across the street from the mall. Some were followed into their urinals. Some were forced to show money if they were allowed to proceed into that mall. But what I thought was interesting about that was that Gladys Radek became a national figure out of that. She rose to that occasion. She used that process that she was engaged in to have her voice heard. And we know that her voice is heard now. Mm-hmm. Very considerably. That's yeah. that. If there's any silver lining, it's that kind of thing.
So she also did the Walk for Justice Canada to Ottawa, and has done that for several years now, right?
That's right.
Yeah,
she's a strong person, a powerful person. It was very interesting with her and the lawyer going through all that and watching her.
So if we had a national inquiry, do you feel like that would be another fiasco? Or
it goes to the terms of reference.
Mm.
It's got to be the right terms of reference.
Yeah.
And it's got to really involve direct engagement of those people, and they've got to get given their chance, and it can't be just a chance for the police to technicalize the issue as opposed to look at systemic problems. And so, you know, there have been good inquiries, and there was one up in Williams Lake around police behavior back in the 90s run by a judge whose name is, I can't think of at the moment, and that report was excellent.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can happen.
It can happen. What do you think about the police in the United States having to wear glasses that have cameras in them while they're doing their shifts so that they can be monitored throughout their entire shift?
I don't know anything about that.
No?
I haven't been watching.
It's new.
You mean like glasses like to see at night or something?
Cameras.
Camera glasses.
They have to wear camera glasses while they're on shift so that we can monitor them for incidences
of
police brutality or, you know, anything like that. I think it's kind of good because it makes them accountable, but it also protects their rights as police officers too, so that people can't scream police brutality when, in fact, they haven't been. They've only been, let's say, quote unquote, doing their job.
Police have important functions. We can't lose track of that. But we've got to also keep our eye on them.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, in the end, our neighborhoods are our own.
Mm-hmm.
And as Woody said, none of these big problems would have arisen for all these Aboriginal women if historic forms of family were still intact.
It's true. Very true.
I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, so that's why my question was, what's the end game? What are we going to do? The history keepers, the timekeepers, met in October down in Arizona, and they're meeting again this month in Mexico. But they're the ones who've been keeping track of the calendars for centuries, but have never spoken out. But they met this time and in Arizona, and one of the things that they agreed to is that the time for secrecy is over. And something else we discussed was this whole issue of racism is really, I guess you might say, a phony construct. It really doesn't have any meaning except in certain social situations where someone's trying to prove their superiority. And so if we're going to survive, we can't start killing each other because of race, and that's what they're doing. And some of it really tickles me, too, like the Aryan Nation. Aryans weren't white people. They're from Persia. You know? So when you start looking at stuff like that, you wonder, and then, you know, we want to keep a race, white race pure. Well, only 3% of the world's population or less is white now.
That we know of.
I mean, and some of us look like it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, those are all social constructions, absolutely. Yeah. Scientifically, race is meaningless. There are other concepts that are better, and we don't want to build a world like that.
No.
But it's not socially meaningless. it's still the basis on which people understand other people and act towards them.
So anyway, the other thing they talked about was that, you know, the Hopis talk about coming into the fourth world, I think it is. And in Haida, our history talked about we're moving back to the first cycle. And it happened in May, this last May, when we started into this cycle that will bring us into a climate change that we've managed to survive a few other times. But our social structures were completely different at that time, in which we learned that we trusted each other and we cooperated. But we've been taught not to trust and not to cooperate, unless it can give me an advantage.
And or an advance.
So the social system that we've been inducted into or forced into is a command-structured society where there's always somebody at the top of the heap. In Haida, if you're chief, nung itlak das, that literally means a big boss who can't give orders. So your chief couldn't order anybody to do anything. Whereas they use the word chief, and there we have many young people now, younger ones, who call themselves chiefs and think that they can do that. So we need to start taking a look at, historically, how did we survive? I guess it's normative, right, rather than positivistic.
Hey, you know, an interesting example of what you're talking about, Woody, is that there's a whole number of young Aboriginal women who are lawyers or law students, mm-hmm. and I've met a number of these people, and they are looking back to the traditional stories of the communities to look to see how lawways were created out of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's all happening now. And it just, this is new, so yeah. Something good is going
to
come of this.
I'd really like to talk to them because,
see,
when I was being taught by those old men, we had a system that translates, I don't have it written down right here, but it translates to social control by obligation and negotiation. In other words, when you live in a tribal society, especially if you're all living in one house, no separate rooms, no privacy, there's always conflict. But how do you resolve conflict without conflict? How do you resolve conflict before it begins? And so through this social control by obligation is where the younger defer to the older. But it's not absolute. There's negotiations too. There are situations in which the younger will take the lead. And so it lays it all out for you as to who is going to, whom will inherit from whom. And it lays out who can you not marry, who is your family, who is all these things. But the real part of it is, how do I avoid conflict? Like, for example, if somebody said something mean to me, instead of reacting to it, I just smile and say thank you. Because I was told that my stature is determined by how tall I am, not how small I make somebody else look. And if I have to make you look small, it's because I feel I'm smaller than you, and I have to bring you down to my level. So when you try to put me down, I say smile and say thank you, because I know what you're doing. Or sometimes, the joking too, with a relative in Haida, the word tawi. That means we're so closely related that we can joke with each other real hard and we can get mad.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of the guys, I had something on my face and I was looking in the mirror and this relative said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm putting medicine on my face." He said, "There's no medicine for ugly."
Only your friends can say stuff like
that. And
so
we could tease each other. Mm-hmm. And one guy, you know, soup dripped from his mouth. He said, "Darn, I missed my mouth." So I asked, how could you miss something that big?
I'll tell you a perfect example of restoring the family or maintaining the family and what it looks like. Last night I was at the Friendship Center, and Sean Edenshaw was there, and he was Jimmy Edenshaw's son. And Sean has a little baby, and her name is Emily. Well, the Haida drummers got up, and they're all drumming and singing. And lo and behold, this two-year-old little girl, dressed in her regalia, gets up and starts doing an honor dance for the dignitaries and the hereditary chiefs that were in the house. And you have never seen anything so serious as this little girl taking her few steps and then putting her hands like this up to her head and looking at the audience and then taking a few more steps and putting her hand up in honor of the Chiefs. And then they did another song. She just would not stop. It was the Raven Dance. She showed us how to do the Raven Dance. Take a few steps, put your arms out like a raven, and make a sound up to the sky. And then she did the Frog Dance. It was so amazing. She captivated everybody's attention. If you've ever been to family night, we go there to talk. We don't go there to watch, right? This is our time to get together with the family. And so this little girl, in essence, really brought it back to the people. She showed us how to dance and to do it without a doubt, you know, and that is the key right now. Yes, it's 3 o'clock.
I think our clock's running away from us.
Our time is up. It was such a great show. Thank you, Bruce Miller, for showing up and
thanks.
Giving us your perspective on the Missing and Murdered Women's Inquiry. And Woody Morrison, always a pleasure to have you here. And thank you so much for bringing the word to your people, Peter Rodriguez.
I was trying.
I'd like to have you back again so we can explore some of these ideas.
Glad to.
Okay, we were talking about serious theme today, to me. So I was preparing a song to end the show, which is in Spanish, but definitely, I wasn't thinking about what that deep the conversation that we have it, right? But anyway, I will try to use these songs to sound a little bit of hope.
Okay.
The same is the song name is Las Flores, which means the flowers, from the Mexican group Café Tacuba, one of my favorites.
All right, let's play it for the families of the missing and murdered.
There we go.
Living my life vicariously.
I'm living life for me now.
You don't know me.
You don't know me.
You probably never will.
You never could, never will, never should. You never could, never will.
You don't own me.
You don't know me.
Come down from Soapboxville.
Cause I can't deny who I be. Crazy Creek.
Well, with friends like you, baby, who needs enemies?
Who needs an enemy? Of enemies.
That's right. Mr. Mamucci. Check it out.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
to me. Don't step to me, I best not be disrespecting me, cause I'm a crazy motherfucker. And most of my life people try to cut me down, trying to bring me down to the level, try to steal my spirit like the devil. Who are you to try and belittle, especially me, even though I don't have a gold medal? Still, in my life I put the pedal to the metal, full throttle, like I'm driving a Mack truck in Vancouver, Ottawa, USA. Ripping it up, living it up, never giving it up, cause I'm reeling this shit. Boy, can't you not see? And I'm feeling this shit, so don't be hating on me. I'm so, so sorry for my authenticity. Still, I guess the best of me, still, I gotta be Cree, Métis, half breed, and live in Calgary. Eventually move to BC so I can make some friends from the Middle East, just to keep my peace with my peeps. Sometimes in the streets, sometimes in the club with the super, super freaks. And we're dancing all night long, like we're running in track meets.
Everybody telling me what I can and cannot do.
Oh.
Well, maybe you know,
oh, baby,
that's just not true. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
You don't know me.
You don't know me.
You ain't no friend of mine.
You never could, never will, never should. You never could, never will.
You don't know me.
Don't know me.
Could you be so kind?
Cause I can't deny.
Yeah, yeah.
Crazy Cree.
Well, with friends like you, baby. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah. This is my life. This is how I'm gonna live it.
That's right.
Jack Mercer from Jack Mercer and the Whiskey Bandits. You're listening to CITR 101.9.
Tell me, tell me.
magic. You're my number one. And really, it's tragic that the storm weather used to be so.
I'm Christine Dibble.
And I'm Carla Slytome.
And we are the KNC Jazz Duo. And you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.